Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed. And today I'm going to be reviewing a book that I have read before. And recently I've been reviewing quite a few books for the second time on the podcast, mainly because I've been doing this podcast now for 6 years. And when it gets to like rereading good books, you know, a 5 year period between reading a book and then reading it again and still enjoying it and finding fresh stuff in, that's a good time span. So recently also I've been doing some episodes with Juliana, my girlfriend, and it helps that I have she goes, hey, what's a really good book to read? And I'm like, check out this book and this book, you know, and then I'll read it along with her and enjoy it at the same time. So I don't mind repeating books, but there's some books which I read and I get such such a high volume of feedback about it. And people say, oh, no, you missed it. You missed this point. You missed this point. It's actually a really good job. You didn't give it a very good review or you rated it. Like people assume that I rate things. Like if I give something 3 stars, I think it's a bad book and people shouldn't read it. If it's a bad book and I don't think people should read it, I'll give it 1 star or 2 stars. But 3 stars is above, you know, 2.5 stars. So it's above average. I do think there's something in there. And so like, books like A Canticle for Leibowitz by Walter M. Miller Jr., which I'm talking about now, it gets that kind of reaction where people go, oh no, you just hated the book because of this. And I'm like, wait, I gave it 3 stars. I didn't hate the book. And what's the other one? There's some other ones as well. What is the Game of Thrones book, the first book, the first book is the Game of Thrones, isn't it? So I reviewed that and gave it like 3 stars or however much it was. And everyone's like, oh, how could you hate this book? And I'm like, no, 3 stars. It's not. So it's strange that these books, which I don't love unconditionally, like so many fans of science fiction or fans of these series or of these science fiction or fantasy classics, people just presume that I hate it. The reason why I then concentrate on some of the negative aspects of these books when I'm doing a review is because it's kind of like me giving a reaction. It's like, well, these books are really loved. Everyone reads them already. Like, it's more like me trying to explain why I don't love some of these books unconditionally, rather than just me saying that they're a bad book. However, there are some books like Snow Crash, which I think is a terrible book and just really, you know, it's like flawed in almost every single way, and yet still people hold it up as a classic of science fiction. In that case, I will just defend my bad views or my views on why it's such a bad book. So that said, lots of people have got given feedback about A Canticle for Leibowitz and saying, oh, you've got these problems with it, you know, and why did you hate it? I don't hate the book. It just annoys me in very many ways. There's lots of good stuff in the book. And there's a few passages which make me so angry, which I'll get onto later. So I have reviewed this before. Got lots of feedback about it, and I didn't go back and listen to my previous podcast, but it's kind of this these episodes of loved science fiction books where I give not a glowing review, which get me all of my 0-star or 1-star reviews on the iTunes store. So if you actually go and check out the SFBRP podcast and check out the reviews of other people, all of the top reviews, all the reviews which people have clicked on and said, yes, most helpful, which then rise to the top of the reviews, are all the 1-star reviews where people have listened to me talking about Snow Crash or talking about Game of Thrones or talking about Canticle for Leibowitz, think I'm a heretic for doing it and that I hate it. So this is kind of in a continuing series, maybe in a future series, of me addressing head-on some of the criticisms of people who don't, like, who think I don't understand, or maybe that I just hate books for no reason, or that I'm an ignoramus or something like that. I don't know. It's a weird thing. I mean, this isn't like a reply to the people who comment on iTunes, because if someone comments on iTunes and gives a bad review and doesn't just email me or something like that, I don't understand it. You know, it's not worth taking those people's criticisms to heart, although it is a bit annoying that the low reviews, like everyone who gives me a 5-star review on iTunes, all of those, which is, you know, 4 or 5 stars is the majority of those reviews are down at the bottom and the 1-star reviews come up to the top. But that's, I guess, always the way, you know, people like the rants, people like the taking apart something in a negative light. So all of that said, as an introduction to this episode, I've made a few notes of, you know, why I wanted to go back and revisit this again. because it is a classic, Canticle of a Leibowitz, because it is such a classic of science fiction, it seems to be held in a regard which is kind of, again, everything I'm saying in this episode is based on my own readings of these books and my own perceptions of why people like this. But I've gone through and read quite a few of these reviews on goodreads.com of other people who've given it 5 stars, and the same things seem to come up time and time again. For example, they say, oh, it's a very funny book. Oh, it brings up important themes. It shows, you know, about how there's a recurrence in history, or the cyclical history, and it shows how, if we don't learn from the past, we're doomed to repeat it. And if we and the Catholic Church saved stuff and got us through the Dark Ages and saved material through the Dark Ages and all of these different things. And I understand, in a way, why people think that is what the book is about, because that is, of course, what the book is about. But what I don't understand is how people just take that reading, that kind of received reading of Canticle for Leibowitz, and just go, that is the way. And even when I mentioned on Goodreads myself that I'm reading it again, people said, oh, it's really good, it shows the cyclical nature of history. And I say, well, what is cycling? Like, they say, oh, the Catholic Church saves this throughout the Dark Ages, saved knowledge throughout the Dark Ages, and yes, that is what this book is about. But I don't understand how people can look at history, then read this book, and read what this book is saying about history, and decide that this book is talking about real history, like out in our real world. It's not. It's a fantasy. It's a satire, in a way, or a parody, which is weird, because people also then say, oh, it's like a satire. But then a lot of these critics or the reviewers still kind of hold up the reading of history which people think is in this book. And it's, and I'm going to explain these thoughts as I go through this review, and I want to try and kind of set it up in advance. What I want to do with this review is actually talk about how I read this book and why I think it's a good book in many ways, but also a flawed book and one that I can't enjoy at a deeper level that other people seem to appreciate it. To bring this back to Snow Crash, this is a book which I don't want to get into now, but there's many times when I reviewed it, many people tried to back up their book. They said, well, how can you say this bad thing here? And I go, and then I explain in depth, like, why it's bad. And I say, it's bad because of this, because of that, because of this. And they go, oh, okay, well, that one specific bad thing, I can forgive that, because the rest of it is good. And I say, but the rest of it isn't good. This scene doesn't work. That factor doesn't work. The characters are stupid. This is stupid. It's just layers and layers of stupid laid on top of other layers of stupid, layered on top of layers of boring and more stupid. And after people admit that all of these flaws, taken individually, are flaws which could be forgiven because the rest of the book is still good, even though the rest of the book isn't still good, it's just flaws all the way down, they say, ah, but actually, it's not a serious cyberpunk novel, it's actually a parody of cyberpunk novel. And this is where I don't understand this approach in the case of Snow Crash, because for me, I don't understand how someone can say that something is the best example of a genre and also a parody of the genre. This is possible. It is a possibility. Snow Crash, I think, fails in that way, that it tries to take itself seriously as cyberpunk. And also, the defense that it's a parody of cyberpunk, while you can read that into it, I think it is a very, just a silly story, which is other people take more seriously than Neal Stephenson, who wrote it. And I think it's a misreading to call Snow Crash good cyberpunk. It could be a very trivial parody of, at the time, not well established genre of cyberpunk, you know. But then people hold it up and say, oh, but, you know, the Matrix, no, it's not the Matrix in that, whatever it is, the cybersphere, I can't remember the name of the, second lifestyle thing. They go, oh, but that's like the internet, it predicts the internet. And it's like, but then I point out that the way that kind of second life thing works is the exact opposite of what makes the internet work, and the exact opposite of everything about it. So people, like, pick out these little bits and pieces, which they say, oh, but that's good, it's good science fiction because of this. Anyway, what it comes down to is that it is possible to have, like, something which is a parody of its own genre and is a good example of that genre. Like, Galaxy Quest is a very good parody of science fiction movies and television, which is in itself a good science fiction movie. However, what we can take away from that, as a, you know, thematically, and what it's saying about the world, it's not actually saying anything about our world or about our history. It's talking about the genre itself. It's talking about the form itself. Like, it's talking about our appreciation of science fiction and how science fiction can make us better people, and us, and like the love of science fiction television is actually a good thing and a heroic thing. It's not just for nerds who, you know, who sit in their bedrooms and get shouted at by their mothers, even though that's what it is. That's what it is. It's the reason why that movie works, Galaxy Quest works, is because it's talking about the genre. It's not, you know, it's talking about life via science fiction, television, and movie genre, but it's not talking directly about our, you know, our real experience, our real world, our real history. It's like, it's that one step removed. And you can't watch Galaxy Quest without being that one step removed. And there's nobody who could ever watch it and say, it is a fundamental example of science fiction, because it is based, the thing is, it's based so much, it can't transcend its own references, it can't transcend its own place in history, because it's so dependent. And I think people look at Snow Crash and they say, it has transcended its influences, even though it's a parody on cyberpunk, but it doesn't. I don't think it does. I just think it's a weak parody. And if you just read it in isolation, away from other cyberpunk, or away from that cyberpunk milieu, which was, you know, around when it was written, I don't think it holds up. Which brings me, that's a long introduction to get to Canticle for Leibowitz, but it brings, I just want to approach it from those two different directions. Like, if A Canticle for Leibowitz is a satire on the Catholic Church and the Catholic Church's approach to existence and relevance in the real world, you can't then divorce that from its own, you can't divorce this criticism or parody or satire on the Catholic Church from its current state of as an entity in the world. And then just skip all of that and just say, this is talking about the real world. This, you know, all of the themes that it brings up about, you know, the cyclical nature of history. You can't skip over the fact that it's a satire on the Catholic Church and go directly to that and then say, it's a great science fiction work because of this. There are reasons why it's a great science fiction work. You know, apparently it's one of the first post-apocalyptic science fiction stories. And that's great. That's no problem at all. Taken away from, you know, the context that it's written in and the history of the person who wrote it, which is someone who actually bombed a monastery. Was it the Monte Cassino Monastery or something like that, and destroyed thousands of works of history that had been saved by the Catholic Church all that time. You know, it's one of those things that if you try to remove it from its frame of reference as a parody or as a satire, it loses any strength that it has. It loses any, like, real, you know, the way that it actually talks about the Catholic Church and talks about the intersection of the church or faith and you know, and how it interacts in the world and how much influence it has. So that's the kind of framework that I want to talk about this book in as I go through some of the sections of it. It might seem heavy, it might seem intellectual, but I feel that that's the kind of setup that I have to give to stop people saying, oh, you just don't like this book because it talks about the Catholic Church and you were once a Christian and now you're not a Christian anymore and you had a bad experience with Christianity, therefore you don't like this book. And I'm like, no, the reason I don't like this book is because, well, I'll get into that, but I need to say all of this in advance because, you know, It's not a knee-jerk reaction why I don't like aspects of this book. I think it's a failed, I think it's a noble experiment, and I think there's lots of stuff in it that's very good, but I think overall it's a failed attempt at a satire, mainly because I think the author just wasn't clear in his own mind about what he wanted to say, in a way. and was obviously very conflicted about these issues, to the point where he committed suicide, even though, like, the main section at the end of this book is talked about assisted suicide and how the Catholic Church is against it totally, and then but he committed suicide himself. And there's no way to read this book as the straight reading that so many people seem to read it, when the author himself, you know, you could talk about the death of the author all you want, but the author himself committed suicide, which goes against everything that this book seems to be talking about at the end. But is it really talking about? No, it's super ambiguous. Everything in this book is super ambiguous, and I think it's that ambiguity and lack of focus, which I think is one of the main failings, or maybe not even a failing, maybe it was totally intentional, but for me, one of the reasons I don't enjoy it. So all of that aside, let's actually talk about this book. It was written in, you know, in the 1950s, I think first published in 1960 or 1951. Actually, I have the Wikipedia page open right here, so I can actually look at. So yeah, it was first published in 1960. It won a Hugo Award in 1961 for best science fiction novel, which it seems to be. I've got no problem with that. It's a very good book, and I understand why it's all meaningful and important and stuff like that. So and it was based on three short stories, which Walter M. Miller Jr. he wrote and then collected together. It says, you know, on the Wikipedia page, he was like, oh, and as I was doing it, as I was writing this one, I realized only after I'd written the first two and was working on the third did it dawn on me that this isn't three novelettes, it's a novel, and I converted it. So he rewrote it and did some bits and pieces of rewriting and added in extra themes and stuff to make it into a single coherent whole. So while it is a collection of three stories, it's meant to be, this version is meant to be read as a novel, so I will tackle it as a novel. So the first story is set 600 years after a global nuclear war, known as the Flame Deluge. I'm just reading from Wikipedia here, I shouldn't really do this, but it's set up that it's post-apocalyptic, and there's in the future, I guess it's in our past, because I'm sure this this nuclear war was meant to have happened in the 1960s or 1970s, or around about that time. So some humans do survive. There's lots of mutations in people, but there's been a papal decree that everyone who is born of God, and that nobody should be cast out or killed or anything like that. There should be no babies killed because they're deformed. So that's playing into the world. The Catholic Church has survived, and there's this one order in the Catholic Church, which is the Order of Leibowitz. And Leibowitz was someone who was a weapons technician. Before the nuclear holocaust, and this guy is Leibowitz, and Leibowitz decided, hey, what we should do is we should try and save as much technical knowledge and history as we possibly can, because there was something known as the Great Simplification, where lots of people decided, hey, technology and knowledge has got us into this mess. Let's kill all of the people who are intellectual and let's destroy all of their work. So there's like this artificially imposed dark age on the world by the author. No, maybe not by the author, but by the Great Simplification, by the masses, the ignorant masses who wanted to kill everyone who is an intellectual. So that's all happening. The first part of the book is set 600 years after this, and it tells the story of Brother Francis, who is out torturing himself for, you know, spiritual gain, living a hermetic life, I guess is the way to say it, but he's becoming a hermit for a few weeks to starve himself into having a spiritual revelation. And during that time, the wandering Jew comes past, and the Jew points at a rock, and he finds a rock, and he looks it up, and he finds some writing from the old Leibowitz. I was going to say Saint Leibowitz, but he's not Saint Leibowitz yet, because all of this first book is talking, it talks about the process of them trying to make Leibowitz into a saint. He's long, long dead, 600 years later, and this the order of Leibowitz in this monastery out in the desert in the United States is wanting him to become a saint, so they can pray to him that he intercedes on their behalf and all the other stuff that comes along with being a saint. And I quite enjoyed this story. However, it's difficult to see this as anything good. Like, the characters within it, like, Francis seems like quite a nice guy. He's utterly pathetic, he's a bit stupid, but he's totally honest that anytime anyone talks to him, he's like, oh, blah, 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 this. And so this first section I actually really, really enjoy, because it's a great example of everything that is, you know, any way that you can write a satire about religion and the way that beliefs come about and the way that supernatural stories get told and that miracles happen. It's like, it's on the level of The Life of Brian, and that is high praise, because in The Life of Brian you get all these scenes where, you know, someone says this and another person says that, and it's like, blessed are the cheesemakers, and all of those great lines from The Life of Brian. It just shows how, when you know, I know it's weird to say this, but this is what humans do. Humans create fantastical stories and then believe in them despite everything, you know, despite all evidence or all good sense. This is what they do. This is what humanity is really, really good at. I have even played experiments on myself to see if I can actually believe something which I know is false. And it's possible. It's really easy to convince yourself that something has happened. You know, I don't want to get into it now, but I have clearer memories of things that I at the time thought, I'm going to pretend to myself this actually happened, and every time I tell the story I add more details in my brain and my memories become less and less thing. And this is just within one person's brain that I can actually believe stuff that didn't happen. And what we see is like the creation of myths and the creation of legends and the creation of a saint and the creation of this. And it talks about, oh, well, what we need is a miracle for Leibowitz. We need miracles. And then a miracle kind of does happen, because there is a miraculous, there is a fantasy element in this book, which is actually really interesting. There is only one. And nobody in the Catholic Church seems to understand that this wandering Jew is actually 2,600 years old. He is actually Lazarus. Maybe not Lazarus, but there is you know, this mythical figure, because Jesus says in the Bible, some of you standing here will not pass away, will not die until I come return in glory. Until I, Jesus, have died and returned, some of you will not die. And that figure is often thought to be Lazarus, who Jesus brings back from the dead. Another point in the Gospels. And they're like, well, one of the people standing there couldn't have died. And for a while that was John, but then of course John died, you know, the Gospel writer John, and so, or the John the Elder, or whoever it is, you know. And if you're actually looking back at the you know, the history of this passage, but of course you need somebody standing there for Jesus not to have been telling lies. You need somebody standing there who didn't die, and that's this miraculous wandering Jew. So he pops up in this book quite a few times in defiance of natural law. There is a miracle, but the Catholic Church never, even though they know he's around and that some people, you know, there's evidence that is presented that he is actually 2,600 years old or more, they don't view him as that. And so there's this battle going on with the Catholic Church to find miracles which are insignificant enough to be like epoch making, or like the miracles have to be big enough to make someone into a saint, as a sign that they are a miraculous being, or that they're interceding on our behalf, or when people pray to them or something, but not big enough miracles that actually overturns their own theology. So it's this weird Venn diagram of miraculous but not too miraculous, interesting but not too interesting, important but not too important. And there's this boundary between like myth and legend and acceptable spirituality. You know, that's a great thing about reading these stories of, you know, what's canonical in the Bible. And they're saying, well, this bit's canonical and this bit's really about Jesus, and Jesus really did this and Jesus really did that. And you go, what about all these other writers over here, which is non-canonical, but like tells Jesus as, you know, as a child, and he's doing all these miracles, and they say, oh, well, that's obviously just fake. That's obviously just people making up stories. And you're like, but the miracles are the same miracles. Him turning water into wine is the same kind of thing. Him walking on the water is the same kind of, it's the same level of miracle. But, you know, it's this weird kind of like accepted miracles and stuff. So that's one of the aspects that I really enjoy about this, is that it's obviously talking about how humans are really good at just making shit up, and the rules that we impose on ourselves to have, like, one of those weird things that it's like, it's not just about, you know, miracles and making people into saints and talking about religious experience, but it actually talks about, you know, what we can believe as true in fiction, you know, our suspension of disbelief. What is important, you know, like, if you're talking about this, it's like, Superman would never do that. It's like, but Superman doesn't exist. He flies around. He's stronger than everything. And he gets killed by kryptonite, but you don't believe he could do this? Like, it's one of those things that you overlook all of the miraculous things or all of the reality-breaking things and concentrate just on this one element of character or this one element of, you know, plot contrivance as the thing that you have. And that's good. However, in this first section, there is lots of these, lots of things where it's meant to be, I think it's meant to be funny, and people say, oh, this is a really funny book. And there are some things that are funny about it, but, like, there's so much which I think I'm meant to be finding funny, but I just find really, really sad. Because, you know, Brother Francis is 17 years old, and the abbot, I think it's Abbot Arcus, and Abbot Arcus is treating, put it this way, it's just abuse. It's, and this is not even like, oh, the child abuse of the Catholic Church these days. It, all of that aside, everything, all these nasty revelations that have come out over the past few years, well, you know, going back decades and things like that, but people are only starting to pay attention now to it. Like, all of these things that come out is beside the point that when you become a Catholic priest, you go through, you know, all kinds of, and when you become a nun, you know, there's all kinds of rituals that you have to go through, which are utterly degrading to you as a person. Like, your individuality is completely suppressed and all of that. But, you know, that's just on, you know, that's just what you know you're getting into. But, like, all of this stuff, which is, it's like the, you know, he's just being beaten, this guy being beaten and tortured and sent out, and it's like, oh, well, if you go here, you'll have a spiritual experience, and then he has a spiritual experience, and he's told not to tell anyone about it, and that it's invalid, you know, it's like this constant negating, and all of this stuff, it's like, ah, you must be ignorant, you must not have this thought, you know, promoting ignorance, and you must lie, you must deny evidence that you have, we will deny this evidence that we have, corporal punishment is fine, torture is fine, everything to suppress anything that goes against our dogma. And while it's written as a comedy, it just makes me cringe, because I'm thinking, this is the setup that people are, like, other people who read this book think is the funny part, or this is the thing that they think made the church the bastion of hope and the keeper of civilization during the Dark Ages as presented in this book. And then because it's presented in this book, and then because they also believe in the recurrence of history, even though this history hasn't repeated, they also, or it didn't even exist in the first place, that the Catholic Church was the thing that kept knowledge alive throughout the Dark Ages, which is totally false, demonstrably false. But because they're reading a fictional account in the future, and they also like the cyclical history theme in the book, they then read back into history, fake history, based on a fake future history as presented by this, which is presented as something bad and wrong and worthy of ridicule and satire by Walter M. Miller Jr. And it's one of those things that if I'm misreading this, like, I don't want to go against the majority of everybody who reads this book and enjoys it, but, like, I can't see any other way to make this book make sense as any piece of writing than to say that it's looking down on the church. For example, the only reason that the church survived throughout the time of, after the flame deluge, after the nuclear holocaust, they survived the simplification because they were totally irrelevant in the world. They had no relevance. They were almost, they were just barely, slightly, more or less ignorant than the ignorant people who wanted to destroy knowledge. They had so little worth and so little knowledge in the world that they escaped everybody else, all the technicians, all the libraries, everything else being burnt and all the intellectuals being killed, the Catholic Church survived that. And it doesn't say they survived that because, you know, they were powerful at the time. No, they survived it because they were totally relevant. And reading into the cyclical history that's mentioned in this book, at the end of the book, they are once again completely irrelevant to the point where, you know, they're just an inconvenience to other people. And the police are like, oh, damn it, you Catholics again, you think you're so important, but you're not, and, you know, they just fly off and escape, and, like, none of their concerns have got any impact on the real world, and that's the only reason why they survive. The only reason the Catholic Church survives at all is because of its total irrelevance. The only reason why Leibowitz uses the Catholic Church to the people of the Catholic Church is because it's the only organization left, and it's this disjointed, completely useless organization which can only exist out, out in what, New Rome, which is Denver or wherever it's meant to be, you know, and out in the deserts. None of this, you know, it survives due to its self-imposed ignorance, you know, its self-censorship of any intellectual spark. That's the only reason it survives. And it continues to survive only because of its continued irrelevance throughout the Dark Ages as presented in this book. And I'm just like, and as I was reading it, I was just, you know, I feel depressed reading it because I'm reading about an irrelevant, like, systematically, I wouldn't say evil, but systematically wrong institution. Filled with really good people. Like, I'm not saying anything bad about the people. Like, Abbot Argos, he's doing what he thinks is right. Brother Francis is doing what he thinks is right. It doesn't make it right. It just means that the system that they live in self-selects for ignorance. It self-selects for conservatism. It self-selects, like, anyone who isn't suited to that life doesn't survive within it. For example, at one point, you know, Francis discovers something. He actually discovers something. He discovers something important. He works out something. He does some historical research and works out something important, that a blueprint isn't white on black. It's actually black on white, but the copying technique makes it that it's a negative of itself. So he goes from going, I don't need to color in all of the ink on the black back, like on the, I don't need to color in all of a white piece of paper and just leave the text. I can just, you know, write the black text on, you know, on, like, just use a tiny bit of ink. But it's like, well, I'll not fix this mistake because there's the guy in charge of the library has a heart condition. And instead of telling him, and it might upset him a bit, I'll just continue with this technique, which I know is wasteful and incorrect and based on all the knowledge I have already, like, technically wrong and historically wrong to keep copying like this. I'll just carry on because this guy in charge has got a bad heart. And I was just like, you know, I'm almost crying at that point. I'm just like, no, this is the single worst thing to do. And then he spends 15 years of his life, like, illuminating this document because he thinks it's so important. And I'm just thinking, well, 15 years, like, just imagine spending those 15 years doing, like, it's like he spent, like, a few hours researching this. Decides that he's doing something wrong, decides not to do anything wrong, and then decides to go in a different direction. I'm just like, 15 years he could have spent doing that same amount of research each time and, like, copying stuff and finding out why it's important to copy. I'm not saying that he should have done it, but, like, why is he the only person that we see do any kind of thing of any worth at all? So, yeah, it's weird. And which brings it back, like, this whole story. People seem to think that it represents the Catholic Church as something good and as something which really did hold back the tide of ignorance during the Dark Ages, which is just so much bullshit. Like, during the Dark Ages in Europe, there was these other empires off to the east, like the Byzantium Empire, who, like, that, it, what, continued through into, like, the 1500s or something, or 1400s, I can't remember, like, 15th century, I always get these mixed up, maybe 16th century, I always get these centuries mixed up. But it survived through holding on to this knowledge to the point that now all of our, well, put it this way, the King James English translation of the Bible isn't based on anything that the Catholic Church kept. It's based on the, you know, the Textus Receptus, which is the Byzantine text tradition from Byzantium, which, like, from, you know, Istanbul, I guess, which you call Constantinople, that it was that area which was keeping the knowledge, which you could say is the Catholic Church, but it wasn't really the Catholic Church. Well, you know, like the Eastern, you know, the Eastern Western split and things like that. But what we think of the Dark Ages, there was a whole empire going on. They're just carrying on as it was before and interacting with the modern world as it was interacting with the modern world. All the inventions that were coming over from the East, like gunpowder, they all reached there first. All the different things, like, you know, the mathematics, it was all going there. They spoke Greek, you know, that it was. That was where a lot of the, you know, the information, you know, and stuff that you get. Like I'm saying, even I'm talking just about the Bible now. Like the best Bibles that we find weren't kept by the Catholic Church because their language, Latin, you know, the Vulgate is what they kept everything. That's what they declared as the, as the gospel truth. Literally, as the gospel truth. That was it. And yes, sure, the Catholic Church or the Church or Christianity across all of this area was relying on this. I read this blog post the other day of a blog that I follow. I mean, all of this stuff about, you know, the continuation and copying text. This is one of my hobbies. This is what I really like about it. If you want a really good introduction, you should read a book. Let me just find the ebook here. I have it in a file. You should read the text of the New Testament. It's the text of the New Testament. It's Transmission, Corruption, and Restoration by Bruce M. Metzger. But read the last the latest edition of the fourth edition, which is also by Bart Ehrman. He did another editing pass and updating and new chapters and things like that. You can read one of those books. It's endlessly fascinating about, you know, how these texts were copied and translated and, you know, how this knowledge has been transferred through the generations and where it's been kept. The earliest documents we have, and I'm just talking about the Bible, the most important stuff that the churches find, like the stuff which survived the longest, it survived the longest by accident. Guy goes along, finds in an old monastery somewhere which has been taken over by, you know, the monastery has been taken over by the, you know, it's now a mosque or something. Goes along, just finds them ripping out pages out of this book and using it to line a rubbish bin or using it to light fires. You know, this kind of stuff happens time and time again. This whole pile of stuff. Then they're like, well, what's this? What's this? And they're like, this is like the oldest copy of the Bible we ever found, and half of it's missing because it's been burnt yet, or something like that. It goes back to, like, you know, 350 AD, or CE, if you want to put it that way. You know, all this kind of stuff happens. Like, the oldest stuff survives by mistake. You know, if you go back to in the 1940s, there was the Nag Hammadi library found in Egypt, and it was buried. And the reason why these texts were buried was because they were classed as heretical, and the church was trying to destroy them. And you think, well, of course the church would try and destroy heretical documents. But you understand that, like, when the church is in charge of keeping hold of history, they have a dogma to correct, to perpetuate. And this is what they try and do. Anyway, this blog post I was getting into, that was all the diversion. This blog post I was getting into, which is talking about a book by David Fitzgerald, and a debate that went on about this book between him and a Christian, I was going to say apologist, but someone who believes in a historical Jesus. This book called Nailed, and it's talking about the Christ myth, and, you know, basically this passage is talking about, like, how much history do we have about the time of Jesus. And people say, oh, we don't have any history about the time of Jesus. That's why Jesus doesn't turn up in any of these historical records. Or there's, like, maybe passing, maybe interpolated, maybe faked passages in, like, later histories which talk that maybe there was somebody who once was, like, worshipped by people called Christians. You know, all these kind of things. And it turns out that, like David Fitzgerald, I'm reading from a blog called Vrido here, which is VRIDAR.org, which it talks about this kind of thing. And this is a review of this section of his book, which is a better summation of that. It's talking about the suspicious state of the surviving evidence. Suspicion is aroused when we understand that Christians themselves were largely responsible for what documents did survive into our times. Going down a bit. So there's an omission of a mention in Jesus in one of Seneca's works on superstition. It says, it is very curious that this book wasn't saved, since nearly everything else that Seneca wrote was preserved. Christians should have loved a text that attacked Jews and pagans, especially by such an eminent pagan philosopher as Seneca. It is also the only Senecan text that we would expect to mention Christianity, and so the disappearance of this particular book out of well over 100 surviving writings of Seneca seems suspicious. And then there is Philo. It says, Eusebius mentioned that Philo also wrote a book on Pilate's persecution of the Jews. One more book where Jesus certainly would have been mentioned. This is Pilate, Pontius Pilate, persecuting Jews. This is, of course, where Jesus would be mentioned. But obviously wasn't, since neither Eusebius nor anyone else ever cites this book for historical documentation of Jesus and his famous execution under Pilate's watch. So that's a book which would have mentioned Jesus, but now doesn't exist anymore. Church Father Hippolytus' magnum opus in his 10-volume A Refutation of All Heresies. At the end of it, Book 1, Hippolytus declares that he will proceed to blow the lid off all secret teachings and mystery faiths, which what Christianity was at its root. But these next two books are mysteriously missing. So the one place that we could have told us how much Christians borrowed or adapted from pagan mystery religions was inexplicably lost from the collection. And then the next loss is from Dio Cassius. This covers the supposed period of Jesus' birth. No single loss like this could be deemed suspicious. But David Fitzgerald points that we see somewhat of a pattern in the context when Christians themselves had primary responsibility for what documents were being preserved. Roman historian Cassius Dio spent 22 years chronicling 983 years of Roman history in 80 volumes. The 35th through 60th books are complete, with just a single exception, Book 55, from the years 12 BCE to 9 CE. Strangely, has a considerable gap in it. What's more, this puzzling blackout apparently is quite pervasive. Even subsequent epitomes by other authors don't know what Dio had to say here, though they can often fill in gaps elsewhere in the text. Oxford historian Peter Swan knows that Dio's surviving material implies that he discussed Herod the Great's death in this section of missing text. But on the other hand, if Dio didn't mention any of the supposed events surrounding Jesus' birth, then this otherwise unlikely hole in the middle of Dio's record suddenly does make sense as a victim of surgical editing by displeased Christian scribes. And this goes on for a new more things like that. His history of the Emperor Tiberius, this is, who is this, Tacitus, yeah. There's a curious gap of 2 years from mid-29 CE to 31 CE, including all of the year 30, often regarded as the likely year of the crucifixion. So what we have here, and this carries on, you know, lots of other, you know, passages where you would think that these histories would either mention the Christians around, you know, in the first century, or would mention Jesus at the time when he was supposed to have lived, you know, in the view. But all of these bits of history just happen to be missing. The rest of the books, still there. Just these section of those books, or just these sections, or just these one books of the other author's overall work, just happen to be missing. Now, I'm not saying that the Catholic Church wants to not preserve history. They obviously do. But it's a secondary thing. It's a secondary motivation. Preserving history is secondary to dogma, to the survival of its own religious institution. And this is what it comes down to with this. Like, there is no way that the Catholic Church can ever be held up as a bastion of anything except itself. Every single thing about it, and it's not just the Catholic Church, but this is the way that religions are selected for in an evolutionary survival of the fittest, you know, kind of way, like a Darwinian way, is that they survive due to being self-serving. Like the idea that if you leave the Islam faith, that you say you're no longer a Muslim, that you should be killed, is a really great way for, you know, Islam to continue on as a religion. It's one of its major strengths, is that people who leave should die, and people who aren't Muslims should die. That's really, really handy for a religion to keep surviving. And it's really, really handy for any Catholic religion or Catholic church to go, anything that goes against our dogma should be purged from the historical record. And what we find in the Canticle for Liberalists, to bring it all back this way, is that same kind of thing. Anything that isn't, that, you know, like, that their main consideration isn't even like, we should be preserving history, this one little section of the Catholic churches. But even there, it's secondary to like, we found this really important historical site. What's the most important thing about this historical site? The most important thing is we find Leibowitz's wife. We have to know that she died, because Leibowitz can't become a saint if he was technically married at the time. That's the most important thing that they're talking about. And I'm just like, how can that be the most important thing? And the whole end of it is talking about this illuminated document and that Leibowitz becomes a saint. That is the overriding concern. And it's utterly self-serving for the abbot. It's utterly self-serving for the Catholic Church. And ultimately, it goes against the stated aim and the thing that other people seem to read in this book. So, moving on. Oh, this is going to be a long episode. I'm very sorry about this. Moving on to section two. Oh, the first one is Fiat Homo, let there be man, which is good. Fiat Lux is the second. Let there be light. Whereas I, the only thing, the only message I find in this book is let there be darkness. The let there be light title is ironic. That's the only possible reading. There is literally no other reading of this book which can say that the Catholic Church was preserving knowledge through this dark age to kickstart a new renaissance. The renaissance happened despite the Catholic Church. And in spite of it, you know, like, going against everything it could do, the Catholic Church actually had the belief that we shouldn't progress. I mean, in the book I'm talking about, in the Canticle for Libris, that we should not progress. Scientific progress, technological progress, should not be allowed to happen until the world becomes pure enough. Of course, the overall message of this book is that the human race will never become pure enough, will never become holy enough, will always be sinful enough, will always be ignorant enough to use the technology for bad. And again, this wouldn't be such a bad thing if people the book, I think, is very, very clear on this, that the Catholic Church is anti-progress. And no, I don't understand how anybody reading this book can think that there is anything about the setup in this book, either in the book or in actually the real history, that showed that the Catholic Church kept any knowledge for the future, which, for the purpose of creating a renaissance in the future, like, that they had any long view. Leibowitz in this book has the long view. Some other specific individuals had the long view. The Catholic Church as an institution does not have the long view. The long view is purely for their own continuing power. Because the underlying thing that they go, we don't think other people should have this power, should have this knowledge and have this power, because it will... In the end, the only reason they say that is because our power will diminish. They go, humanity is not ready for technology. Humanity is not ready for this extra power and this extra technology and these, like, gunpowder and things and all that other stuff. But the only reason that seems to be is because the Catholic Church will, in comparison, diminish in power. And you know what? That's what happens. In part three, the Catholic Church is... It has no power anymore. Like, even in the second book, it's like, if this king invades, what we'll do, we'll excommunicate him. And guess what? Nothing happens. You can excommunicate anyone you want. But the Catholic Church, even then, it said, like, only 20% of the people, the other people were in the cults, and only 20% of the people believed in the Catholic Church anyway. So there are some documents which survived, and it's like, it turns out this one was really important, you know, or this one had some really good big clues in it. And you're like, that's impressive. But they make this machine. Those ones that do survive, like, accidentally, because they survive through ignorance. You know, Leibowitz did his best, but there obviously wasn't very much. So they make this machine which makes light. And at the end of it, they turn the light off and like, even the person who made the machine who created light is like, probably best not to let electricity out in the world. And the whole theme is like, cyclical history, eternal recurrence, because back in the day, Prometheus let out the thing and that. But of course, they go in this because it's, they're talking more, you know, Christian or, you know, the Jewish, I don't know what to say, but like the Abrahamic religions all come back to, you know, the creation and the fall of Adam and Eve and blah, blah, blah. However, again, this reading is like a whitewashing of that. Well, not even a whitewashing, blackwash. It's talking about how bad it was that the human race knew that, like, Adam and Eve got the knowledge of good and evil. But the story that the orthodox interpretation of this story is again flawed because, you know, the serpent says, hey, you should really eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And the reason why God, the gods at the time, the Elohim, the group of gods who created the humans, were like, well, they can't eat from both the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, because if they do, they'll become too powerful and too populous, because the tree of knowledge of good and evil was sex. So eternal life plus sex and procreation means we gods are going to be overrun by these pesky humans. That's what they didn't want to happen. And Eve said, ah, but God said that if we eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, we will die that very day, or we will die. And Adam, you know, and God's like, yeah, you will die. And Adam's like, yeah, but if we eat from that tree, we'll die. And the serpent says, no, you won't die. You'll be fine. And guess what? The serpent is right. God was wrong. The serpent was right. They don't die. They do get the knowledge of procreation, and they do go and fill up the earth with these pesky humans. And then a lot of the rest of Genesis is dealing with the fallout of that, that they're still the sons of the gods, and they're still the sons and daughters of Adam and Eve, and there's all the kind of stuff going on. There's still battles going on into the future about that kind of thing. So even the whole basis that knowledge coming into the world is inherently a bad thing and that will kill you, you can't use the story of Adam and Eve eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil and them dying to be a bad thing. Because if it is a bad thing, they wouldn't have been able to procreate and the human race wouldn't exist. So you either have procreation and existence and growth, or you have ignorance and no growth. And the Catholic Church is on the side of ignorance and no growth. Sure, humans do stupid stuff, but you can't then talk about the like the cyclical nature of history and say, oh, we're going to destroy ourselves with nuclear war, and then in the future, another 3,200 years into the future, it's going to happen again, and there's going to be a cycle, because that cycle hasn't started yet. That is a cycle. There are lots of things. There are lots of places where history repeats itself, but continuing dark ages and non-dark ages and destroying of the whole of humanity and the resurrection of the whole of humanity, that is not a cycle that exists. And you can't just say, oh, this book is about that cycle. No, this book is about the belief that that cycle can happen. This book is about the belief that the Catholic Church has that the introduction of knowledge and technology and progress is inherently a bad thing because it gives too much power to humans and we don't know how to deal with that. You can't skip over the point that we're talking about the belief and the dogma of the Catholic Church here and of their view of technology and science and progress in the past. You can't just skip over that and say, this is what humanity is and this is what human history is. You have to go through that this is a satire on that. And unfortunately, the Catholic Church doesn't pass that test. The earth hasn't been destroyed. It may be in the future, but we can't just say, because the earth may be destroyed in the future, we have to discount all of the good stuff that comes with the progress. Because guess what? It isn't the priests who are having the hard lives. It isn't the Catholic Church. It isn't the Pope who lives in a palace. It isn't all the bishops who live in palaces. It's like all these big scandals in Germany at the moment about this bishop here spent like 57 million euros on his home, and he's got like a mansion here and a palace here. You know, this all of this kind of stuff does go on. Some Catholics aren't like that. I'm not going to tie everyone in the same brush, but the people with the power do live in the palaces. The people with the power who are against, like, nobody in the Vatican is worried about dying of AIDS when they preach that everybody in Africa should be at the risk of dying of AIDS. You know, nobody in the Vatican is really wanting to get gay married when they talk about how gay marriage shouldn't be allowed for other people. This is, you can't take one thing with the other. You can't say that the Catholic Church is right about this and wrong about, like, you've got to take it as a full package, but you can't selectively take things about the Catholic Church that they do right, divorce it from that, take stuff which they are literally and demonstrably wrong about, tie it in with the stuff that they're right about, and then say, oh, and the Catholic Church is fine about this. They're right about this. And because this very, very ambiguous reading from the Canticle of Leibowitz may or may not appeal to me personally, I'm then going to apply it to all of history. There's a disconnect there which I can't get over. Which brings us... Oh, let me just check my notes again. To fiat voluntas tua, One thing I didn't like about this book, there's lots of Latin in it, and I don't speak Latin, and it's not translated. But anyway, this is translated as "Let thy will be done." And this is the thing where if the book finished at this second, at the end of this second section, if it finished, you know, fiat homo, fiat lux, let there be man, let there be light. If it finished there, I think this book would be, I wouldn't give it 5 stars, but it would be like 4.5 stars or something. But it all falls apart in this last section, and yet, because it is written as a novel, or is collected together by the author as a novel, it's more than just a fix-up novel, because it's, you know, he's tied together, he's like, yes, I'm going to release this as a novel. And it won a Hugo Award as a novel, not as a short story collection or anything like that. And it's well-known as a novel. I've got to take this last section in, and this is where I think the whole book falls apart, because of the beautiful subtlety, which is so subtle that it's fooled, like, 2 generations of science fiction readers, and everyone who reads it now and doesn't get the subtler point. This ruins... like, this last section kind of is so heavy-handed in its view that the church is a force for good or something. Like, I read this review and it says, oh, and it's really great that, you know, I'm not going to look through the Goodreads page now, but that objective morality is better than subjective morality. People are saying, oh, is all that the human... in the book, there's a quote which is like, is all that humanity... actually, maybe I can... find this, because I looked up, there's this section where it's on Goodreads, it's can't find it. Section on Goodreads, which is quotes from Canticle for Leibowitz and stuff, which has lots of stuff, but I can't find the quote very quickly, but it's pretty much saying that, like, you don't I've lost my train of thought here. But the point is that it's very, very clear that some people, like, from these reviews, are taking this last section as where it really picks up. And it's like, yes, and now this one character seems to really put his foot down. And, like, now I'm really standing up for my beliefs. And I only read it. It's the single most depressing thing that I've read. This Catholic priest is the abbot of this abbey, is trying to stop a mother and a child from committing suicide, or the mother wanting to commit suicide, and this whole aided euthanasia thing. Like, it's just horrific, because there's literally nothing about this which makes any position by the Catholic Church on any subject even remotely they say objective morality. Like, there's nothing about any of it which makes it possibly seem like anything except utter self-serving dogma. And I can't even understand people who can read this and see anything other than the evilness of the Catholic Church on innumerable positions, moral positions, that every single position that they've ever had, which doesn't come from just sort of like humanity, like humanism, every position that they have on morality is self-serving and controlling and manipulative and just abusive, and to the point, and of course, people dying and people killing, and sort of like it's playing into the killing of people who are going to die anyway from radiation sickness, who volunteer to die anyway themselves, who have to sign themselves over, who have to be checked by a doctor to make sure all the safeguards put in place. And it's sort of like, this is like the Holocaust by the Nazis in the 1930s and 40s. You know, it's that kind of thing. Like that's the level that has to be brought against any action in the human world out of human compassion, that the Catholic Church's position can even remotely be seen as caring or pure or holy. It takes that level to get there. And yet, where was the Catholic Church during the Holocaust? They were irrelevant. In the same way I said before, they were irrelevant. You can't have a reading of the Catholic Church as the last bastion of human morality or against, you know, societal morality, against humanism, the values of humanism and compassion. there's no way, like, it's a parody of its own position. There is nothing there, and that's why I think it fails at this point. This book fails at this point because all it does is show the Catholic Church for what it is, but it's kind of taken it too much to the extreme. The parody, the satire is so much on the surface that there's nothing, that all I have in the end is the anger at the people involved, because the abbot at that point is like knowingly and intentionally evil and violent, and yet somehow gets salvation at the end by this two-headed woman who is like the new incarnation of Mary, and there's an Immaculate Conception going on there and stuff, and all that kind of stuff. I'm just like, how does this character, how does the Catholic Church come off at this at the end of this as the hero? The only reason they manage to survive at all is by the complete irrelevance. They manage to send a spaceship into space to continue... What? Continue what? Not continue humanity and continue, like, civilization, but to continue the Catholic Church. That's the main consideration of everybody involved who's leaving. That if these guys go along, the throne of Peter, like this, like the papacy, is going to be going into heaven and going to go along with all the colonies in space rather than being on Earth. That's the thing that's most important on their mind. Utterly self-serving of their own regard. There is nothing. And this abbot tells this story to a woman who is considering killing herself and her child, is telling the most horrific story about him trying to kill one of his own cats, which is a story I can relate to, because once I found, it's talking about a cat who was hit by a car and its back legs were crushed. And he tried to kill the cat and it took him a really long time, and the cat was trying to get away to die under a bush, but he was trying to kill it and all this kind of stuff. I understand that because me and my brother once found a rabbit whose back end had been squashed by a car and it was trying to pull itself off the road, and we're like, we'll put it out of his misery. And then we then proceeded to pretty much torture this rabbit and failed to kill it for like 5-10 minutes. Like, we just didn't know what we were doing, like, in the same way that this abbot. So it's like a personal story for me, but like, I would never tell that story to somebody who has a pet rabbit and is stroking a pet rabbit, or their pet rabbit is dying, and I'm like, oh, well, your pet rabbit is dying and you want to put it out of its misery. Let me tell you the story of how I failed to put this rabbit out of its misery in the most horrific way possible. He's just torturing, and this whole book is just full of people being tortured by the Catholic Church and, like, being these simpering wrecks about it. It's like, okay, you literally keep hitting me. You literally keep smacking me around the head. You literally keep beating me until I say the thing that you want to hear me say, even if I don't appreciate it. It's like the summer of 1984, which Juliana was, we were just discussing this morning, we were just chatting online about that, and how she really didn't like having these scenes of torture at the end of it, and didn't like that the person came around. That's what I find at the end of Canticle for Leibowitz. We find someone who is berating, using the power of God, of the power of God instilled in me, I command thee. It's not even like I beseech you, I can't remember the exact words, but it's like, I abhor you not to do this. And it's, for me, it reads like Big Brother, and that's what that's why the end of this, I really disliked reading this section, because it is so painful for me to do. The whole book up until that point feels like, you know, it has that whimsy, it has that satire, but then it goes from satire into just pure cynicism. And again, it's difficult to read it in any other way, that Walter MJ Miller is in any way connecting himself with the views of this person, because he committed suicide. Like it's just, like, he went against the teaching of the main torturer at the end of this book, this vicious, vile person who somehow gets redemption, and it kind of flips it round, it flips the parody around 180 degrees and kind of makes a parody of, you know, the opposing view. But that's my view. You know, my view is humanism. My view is not morality based on dogma and the self-service of the church. And it feels like my views are being made into a parody at the end of this book, rather than the Catholic Church's and the position of dogma throughout this book. This is, for me, two-thirds. Actually, it's more than two. It's like three-quarters of the book, these first two stories, I think, wonderful and subtle. And then it kind of flips around and it just feels like someone's just punching me and beating me in the face. And that's in the same way that Juliana, she said, like, the 1984 would be a 5-star book for her. It's like something that she really appreciates. I guess you can read her review of it on Goodreads. She just told me she was posting it there. But there's so much stuff which she just finds unpleasant, you know, and the overall story is just unpleasant and she can't get enjoyment out of that. And while in 1984, I think it works, that whole thing that works together, that there is no hope, there is no way out. There is no, you know, like the three powers, Oceania, Eurasia and East Asia, they're all as bad as each other. There's no escape. We're told that the Big Brother will prevail and he will love Big Brother and that history will be rewritten and that things will go the way that Big Brother wants, or the whole system wants, the system itself wants. Like, we're told that's what's going to happen. And then it does happen and it's not comforting. And again, I understand why you don't want to read something like that and you don't enjoy reading it. And that's what I find with this end section. Actually, all the way through, but most specifically the end section of the Canticle for Leibowitz. That's what I feel about it. And again, one of the things that almost upsets me most about this is that I don't think my reading is the wrong reading from what I find. Like, what is written, I don't understand how people can take positive messages about this book of anything. Humanity is fucked up, and that's what this book is about. It's about humans. Even the best humans, we put in place systems for ourselves which can perpetuate evilness and perpetuate, I say evilness in a way, like, but when it gets to the point where you're torturing people, and when it gets to the point where, like, literally and also figuratively, like, that you're berating people who are so sick that they literally want to kill themselves, and you are browbeating them, it's inhumane on every level. And yet I think we're meant to find the people in this book humane. Like, Brother Francis is a nice guy. The abbots, the poets, well, maybe not the poet, but, you know, all these other characters who come and go in this book, we're meant to find them personable. And I do. I really like Brother Francis. I really do like the abbots in the first thing, the priests and the librarian. All of these guys are really earnest and they're humble and they do trying to do the right thing. They don't understand that the rules that have been set for them means that them doing the right thing is just hurtful and perpetuate bad stuff in the future. But what we get is, what makes it so playful in those first two sections is that we understand that those same systems are being put in place in the secular world, that humanity can't escape from the bad systems that we build for ourselves, like the Catholic Church, or, you know, these different abbots and the priests and the Pope and stuff. They're doing one thing in one direction, but then we actually, you know, read about the secular politics and it's no better. It's no better at all. The only thing that we can do to make it better is to try and, I would say, break free of the systems of oppression, but we need to base our personal morality and our, like, societal morality not on anything dictated by dogma. And unfortunately, the Catholic Church is the number one example of this, but there are other examples. For example, modern politics and modern economics and all these other kind of stuff, there are a few people who are evil, and there are a few people who know better, but they're just out for selfish gain. But most people think they're doing the best thing within the system that they're in. They're being rewarded by the rules of the system, and the system has evolved over many years, like the Catholic Church has evolved over many years. Our secular society has evolved over many years, that we have to, as humans, as individuals, we have to examine the rules that have been set for us as society and decide if those rules are good for us and if they're not good for us. And personally, that's what I try and do. You know, I do so much. Like, even this podcast is something that, like, I can see myself always putting work into self-serving issues, into self-serving projects. But I want to, in my own personal life, I want to increase net happiness in the world to a higher degree, like, to the same degree that I try to increase personal happiness, which means that for every gig that I do that I get paid for, I try and do the same amount of work and give it away for free. That's why I give away this podcast for free. You know, I'm not interested in using this podcast for personal gain. Like, that's why these podcasts are released under, you know, Creative Commons 4.0 licenses, which means that anyone can take them. And as long as the attribution comes back to me, and that's what it is, it's like, it's as good as public domain. Anyone can use these podcasts to do anything with and try and make as much money off them as possible. That's no problem. My photography, I release all of that under Creative Commons. And I think these, I know these are just small examples, but there's so many other things that I try and do to encourage participation in life affirming and life building up activities, you know, with my juggling and helping run juggling shows and setting up, you know, like the British Young Juggler of the Year show to encourage other jugglers to get into it and enjoy juggling more at a professional level. All these other things that I do, and I don't want to sound like I'm preaching, but these come in spite of any religious upbringing that I had, or maybe because of my rejection of religious upbringing, that I realized that all of my activities either have to benefit me personally and my own happiness personally and my own relationships personally, you know, in a beneficial way, or they have to benefit humanity's current life. You know, I can't put my time and effort and money into trying to save people's souls or trying to save people's eternal souls or try and further the benefits of an organized religion. I personally can't do that, and I find it very sad that people can read A Canticle for Leibowitz and come out with the opposite opinion, that they think that they should, that the Catholic Church is worthy of anything except derision and contempt for any of its moral stances, and anything that they might have done throughout history which has benefited humanity and the arts or any of these other things or culture in any way. Everything that has ever come out of the Catholic Church is a byproduct of its own insularity and its own dogma and its own self-service, you know, its own self-servicing. You can't say that. Like, it's really difficult to look at the Catholic Church and say, go and invade Jerusalem in the Crusades. You know, there's no way to look at that as anything other than self-serving for dogma and religious reasons and hold it up as anything positive in the world. And that's the kind of stuff that has to be weighed. The few fragments, the few bits of knowledge which supposedly people think the Catholic Church or the Western Catholic Church supposedly saved, that hadn't been saved elsewhere, the supposed good that any of the Catholic Church has ever done, is outweighed in so many other, or put it this way, it has to be considered alongside all of the bad stuff that the Catholic Church has done, along with every other system, religious or secular, that has been created in the world. And that's what this book teaches me, that you've got to pick your way through that. You have to see that every system has, even populated 100% by good people, has within it both the good and the bad, and you've got to decide that. You can't just take it on faith. You can't just take it on dogma. You've got to find your own way. And I think on that theme, on that note, I think I've covered everything that I want to say, even though I haven't really talked about the stories or what even happened. I think that's more of an in-depth discussion, which hopefully addresses some of the points that other people, or the criticisms that other people had about my last review, and they thought I'm just disliking this book because I have issues with the Catholic faith. No, I'm disliking this book because I think it's clumsily written in the last third, or, you know, it doesn't hang together as a coherent whole. And I also challenge you and your reading of this book to really examine what's going on in this book. And if you still think that you can go against my last hour of talking about this book and you can convince me that this book is actually a statement about the true cyclical nature of history, you have to back up that history that is cycling has actually happened for this book to be a comment on the real world, rather than this book to be a comment on the orthodox view of the Catholic Church, of its own self. And if you don't understand that, your view of the Catholic Church is what this book is challenging, or that's what this review is telling you that this book should be challenging about your own view. And if you don't understand that, I think this book has gone over your head. And it's really weird for me to say this, but, like, there is you're in the majority. I am very much in the minority. But the guy who wrote this book killed himself. You've got to understand that. There is no way that you can take this book as what the author thought about the real world. It has to be seen through the view that this is a satire and a comment on the Catholic view of the world, not on the real world itself. Just as the Galaxy Quest is not a statement about the real world, it's a statement about the view of science fiction on the real world. You know, it's about the way that we see the world through science fiction, not about the real world. You have to have the intermediate step, and I think most people are missing that intermediate step when they read this book. And that's my challenge to you, the reader, who gives Canticle for Leibowitz 5 stars. If you want to give Canticle for Leibowitz 5 stars and still think and see it in my view, that's fine. But if you give it 5 stars and think that it has anything to say about the real world rather than the real world through the view of the Catholic Church, you are looking at the real world through the view of the Orthodox, you know, through the Orthodox, the glass, you have your Orthodox Catholic whitewashing of history spectacles on, and that's the way that you're viewing the world. Meanwhile, me over here in the real world, or in that non-view or a different view, I've got other opinions. So that's all I have to say. You can check out this book. I listened to this as an audiobook. Really good audiobook, by the way. Let me just see who the narrator is. Tom Wiener. I've listened to him before. I definitely recognize the name. Anyway, really good stuff. Got it from Audible. If you want to get this book for free and listen along, just check out audibletrial.com/SFBRP. If you do that, you can sign up for a free trial. And in doing so, you get a free book. And also you help out the me and the SFBRP. So I can also keep buying books elsewhere and, you know, just supporting the costs of doing this podcast. If you've got any comments about this, please email me, luke@juggler.net. But probably the best thing to do is to join in the discussion. I'm probably going to make a discussion topic on the SFBRP listener group, or just discuss it directly on my review on goodreads.com. That's probably the best way to get there. It's goodreads.com. Look up me, become my friend, see my review on this and comment directly on my review, because then other people can join in the discussion there. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm @LukeBurridge. On Twitter, you can check out my blog and stuff. That's lukeburridge.com. You can find my blog and other stuff there too. Next up, I'm going to go back to another book that in a series that I've got, which is by Jason Hoff. I actually looked it up after the last review. It's called The Dire Earth Cycle. I was just calling it the Darwin Elevator Trilogy, but it's The Dire Earth Cycle. And the last book is actually The Plague Forge. I thought it was The Plague Force, but it's because of the typography on the image of the front cover. I thought it was Plague Force, but I misread the G as a C. So it's The Plague Forge. I just started that this morning. And yes, I'll have a lot to say of the whole Dire Earth Cycle, the whole trilogy, once I get to the end of that. So, that's it for me. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.